Welcome to the Meb Faber Show, where the focus is on helping you grow and preserve your wealth. Join us as we discuss the craft of investing and uncover new and profitable ideas, all to help you grow wealthier and wiser. Better investing starts here.
Meb Faber is the co-founder and chief investment officer at Cambria Investment Management. Due to industry regulations, he will not discuss any of Cambria's funds on this podcast. All opinions expressed by podcast participants are solely their own opinions and do not reflect the opinion of Cambria Investment Management or its affiliates. For more information, visit CambriaInvestments.com.
Happy New Year, everybody. We got a special episode today. Our returning guest is Rick Rieder, BlackRock's CIO of Global Fixed Income and the head of their global allocation team. Today's episode, Rick shares his take on the macroeconomic landscape as we kick off a new year. He touches on the setup for both stocks and bonds and why he's focused on finding companies that have, quote, rivers of cash flow. We talk about several other topics, including crypto, AI, Japan, the recent shift by the Fed, U.S. debt levels, and much more. As we wind down, Rick touches on his entrance into the ETF space this year with two fund launches. Welcome to the party. If you want to listen to Rick's first appearance on the podcast last fall, check out the link in the show notes or scroll back to episode number 446. This episode is brought to you by 10East. Longtime listeners know I've invested in private markets quite a bit myself, but with access to these markets broadening, it can be hard to know where to find vetted, high-quality offerings. That's where 10East comes in. 10East is a platform where qualified investors can co-invest on a deal-by-deal basis across private equity, private credit, real estate, venture, and other one-off opportunities typically unavailable through traditional channels. They're founded and led by Michael LaFell, who spent his early career building Davidson Kempner and who invests material personal capital in every offering they bring to the platform, aligning interests with 10East members who co-invest at their discretion. Join numerous founders, executives, and portfolio managers from leading investment firms who use 10East to diversify their personal portfolios. Inquire for membership at 10east.co. That's the number 10east.co. Please enjoy this episode with Rick Rieder. Rick, welcome back to the show.
Thanks, Rob. Thanks for having me on. Appreciate it.
We had so much fun last time. You were hanging out with an ETF guy, and lo and behold, welcome to the party.
Thanks. I mean, you know, it was a party that seems to be getting more and more well attended. So we're, now the number of people that are in the space, excited about the space, the number of models that drive around ETFs. I mean, I think de facto, you got to be in the space. We'll continue to grow. I mean, mutual funds are still a really, really good avenue. More and more people want to be in this ETF space.
Well, great. I want to touch on those later and the strategies within them. But we last spoke about a year ago. Listeners, you can find the show note link to the episode. It was a lot of fun. The world felt a little different. It was kind of a nasty year for markets last year. This year has been a bit different, as they always are. Give us a little high-level thoughts. What's the macro environment now? I think the Rick word cloud last year would have been polyurethane. I don't know what your word cloud this year is, but give us an overview of what you're thinking about.
I think the resilience of the U.S. economy, that was why we use that polyurethane thing. It's the resilience of the U.S. economy is incredible. Like everybody said, we're going into recession, I still don't think we're going into recession, although I think we're slowing. But I think people underestimate the extraordinary resilience the U.S. has, technology, service economy, et cetera. I've used this this metaphor of the diving board. Like you can't make a big splash until the diving board's really high. And we just went through, in 150 years, we haven't seen interest rates back up this much and create a negative total. We've had higher interest rates, but you've never seen the total return of, for example, the 10-year treasury exhibit this sort of loss this quickly. And so I always say that you can't generate real returns or make a big splash until you lift the diving board higher and higher. And then, you think about after financial crisis, after periods of real downturns, that's when returns are better. And today, I think we're moving more to a normal economy. Next year, our projection, Fed's projection, pretty close to this, 1.5% real GDP, 2.5% inflation, pretty stable. Life never goes the straight line to stability. But my sense is if that's right, you're still getting to buy fixed income yields at levels that are incredible. Like you can lock in 6, 6.5. Go out a little bit on the curve. You don't have to go that far out, meaning you can generate real return, particularly in fixed income. And you've seen like the last month and a half, like all of a sudden like pretty spectacular equity-like returns. And you know, my sense is you won't continue to see spectacular equity-like returns, but the ability to build income for what is, you know, after equities had such a terrific run, to augment what you own in equities is, well, that's a pretty phenomenal thing. And my sense is a year from now, people will say, gosh, remember we could buy this stuff at like 6, 6.5 without taking a lot of risk.
Well, you know, it's funny you mentioned that. Like, if you were to say the theme this year in my mind, outside of my world, I feel like the T-bills and chill, this resurgence of having yields for fixed income investors, particularly the everyday sort, like you've seen money markets, just that number in their head, 5%, feels like a very behaviorally significant number. Now, as you mentioned, a lot of these long bonds, I mean, I think the drawdown on the 30-year was darn near half, right? And I feel like if stocks did that, everyone would be losing their mind, going crazy. But bond investors are a little more sober, I think. I don't know. But this seemed like an event that felt very rare in markets. Why do you think investors in general, and maybe they didn't, tell me kind of your experience, handled it so well? Is it kind of they saw the yield side of it versus, you know, the significant losses on these long bonds?
So it depends who you talk to. I mean, three straight years, pre-November-ish, three straight years are pretty devastating. Like you said, a long bond, 30-year treasury, it was the May 2020 30-year treasury was trading at $47.5 price. People don't regard that. Argentina has debt that trades, you know, people don't view U.S. treasuries like AAA asset, best asset in the world, safest asset in the world, I should say. Trading 47, that's pretty remarkable. So depends who you were in terms of the reaction function to that. But like you say, there's been this sucking sound of people saying, I don't want to own any of this stuff. Get me into bills. And the amount of money sitting in money market, $7 trillion-ish, depending on how you measure it, sitting in money market funds, get me 5, 5.5 going into bills. And like I'll sleep at night, tax sufficient. The thing that I think is part of your beginning question that I think, and you know, I think every time I did a meet, probably on your show as well, you know, people say, what's your favorite investment? I'd say 1 year commercial paper for, I don't know how many months, 1 year commercial paper. You know, you can get 6 at 1.6.5 almost. Now, like I think the Fed's cutting rates. Like, you know, are they going to start March or May, right? You know, June, you know, it's hard to, I think they'll start May, but it's not. So what happens? Like 5.5 is a fleeting number if they really are going to cut rates aggressively. So my argument is you go out, you don't have to go that far out the yield curve. You don't have to go to 30 years and take the volatility around it, particularly the 30 years at 4%. Like not interesting at 4%, unless you're a life insurance company or pension that has to own it. But you can go out to the 3-year, 5-year part of the curve, buy a lot of things like investor-grade credit, agency mortgages, a little bit of high yield, European high yield, you can still build a little bit of a 6, and maybe the 6, because of if rates rally, the 6 can turn into a 9 or 10 from a total return perspective. So at some point you got to jump off that diving board. Well, I'm doing it personally. I'm doing my funds. Like I think it's worth locking some of this in.
So we were doing some fun stats, and these aren't particularly actionable insights, but for me, it's more sentiment related, where I was talking on Twitter and I said, you know, as far as like the long bond, really, and it doesn't look like it's going to happen now after this ferocious rally over the last month or so. But I said the only time sequentially had been down 3 years in a row, and this is nominal, not real, but was late 70s, early 80s. And obviously the future returns were great after that, marking a slightly different, you know, level of interest rates, but phenomenal returns since then. And I think we're going to print a positive year now. At least it looks like it. We still got a week or two to go.
Do you know that? Because the rates were high back then, and because for long discussion about the duration, because when you have rates super low and then that's your starting point, even with rates being, you know, that period, this was worse from a total return perspective because you were getting no coupon and where rates were starting from. So your price return was horrendous. So like as bad as it wasn't, you think, no, we're double digit interest rates from a return perspective, this was even worse.
You said things have been strong in the economy, which they have. And I feel like that's been a bit of an outsized voice this past year. I think the big topic that I imagine we were talking about last year, really everyone was talking about, was this concept of inflation, which got really scary for American investors that have the PTSD of decades past. And then it seems to be mellowing out. Do you see this as something that is mostly behind us at this point?
So I think inflation is coming down. And I think it'll keep coming down. Listen, we went through a war that created an incredible dynamic around food prices, energy prices, on the backside of a pandemic that it created logistics, real challenges around supply chain. And so if you go into next year, we think by January, you're going to see core PCE in the twos. And then, you know, by the end of the year, we think 2.5. There are a couple of things that are the governor on maybe some stickiness to inflation. One is wages are still high. Service level inflation tends to pivot off of that. Two, there is truth around infrastructure spend, infrastructure climate-oriented spend, near-shoring, reshoring. So there's some stickiness to it. That being said, people say inflation is going to be high for years, or artificial intelligence, we're going to go through a productivity enhancement. People say, gosh, here's where we're going to be a year, 2 years hence. I mean, AI, I just read a study that showed the amount of impact on AI a few months ago. It could be incredible, like the number of augmented, you know, business functions, et cetera. So anyway, my sense is long-winded way of saying, I think inflation is coming down. I think that supply chain shock is largely done, you know, save some other major event. And so I think we're going to get to a more normalized, but we project inflation is coming down to 2.5. You know, we ran for 20 years at under 2, 1.5 to 2. So there's some stickiness in there, but by the way, the Fed can live with 2.5 and so on. I'm pretty outspoken about.
Good. Well, all right. So we're getting a presence in our stocking, not coal. Let's talk a little bit about market outlook 2024. So we turn the page on 2023. Do you have any favorite areas, sectors, geographies? What type of investments look particularly interesting?
So I mean, the first thing I would say is, you know, Peru discuss like build a 6.5 and, you know, lock it in for 3 to 5 years. And so my favorite is in a fixed income. Now, some of these investment grade credit agency mortgages, securitized assets, like build the 6.5, like build that thing. You know, you can still own high yield. We're not going to have a default cycle. And by the way, use Europe. The U.S., as if you're a dollar investor, you know, I'm going to get too technical. But if you, because of the, you know, what's called a cross currency base, because as a dollar investor, you get a benefit from investing European assets. You build things like European high yield, you get 10%. Investment grade in Europe, you get 6.5. By the way, we used to finance European investor grade at negative yield. Think about that. For in 2021, 88% of the front end of the year was negative yield. So those assets I love. Just put them away. And then, you know, then I think the equity market is going to do its thing. Like we had spectacular returns driven by 7 stocks. But I think next year, I think for the next couple of years, I said, oh, gosh, I'm going to buy 60-40. I'm going to take 60. I'm going to hold my equities. There are a lot of sectors within equities that the multiples are okay. Energy, healthcare, defense, and they trade at 14, 15 multiple and or less, and free cash flow multiples that are really, really low. So the level of nominal GDP is still pretty darn high. So companies can generate 10% return on equity. So on average, boy, you throw off 10% return on equity, the multiple's not stifling. Like, I don't know. Like, I think equities will do 8 to 10 to 12, and then I'll build, you know, I'll put 6, 6.5 in fixed income. Life is okay. It'll never get there straight line. I'm certain of that. I've done this too long to realize it's not going to be straight line to nirvana, but I think you can have a pretty good go.
We've heard so many times this people talk about traditional portfolios, 60-40 being dead, and it did have a kind of a nasty year in 2022, but that resets the opportunity set, right? When things go down, usually yields go up, valuations go down, things look better. That's the way this kind of works. You mentioned the Magnificent Seven and then equities doing okay. Do you have to move away from market cap weight? So, you know, the market cap weight obviously having a pretty heavy tilt in that and weighting in those indices, and most investors are market cap weighted. Do people have to start to tilt away or lean away from the market cap to get those kind of 8, 10, 12?
For the first time in my career or my personal investment history, like I love tech. Like I think I call it the fast rivers of cash flow. Like you want to be in these companies growing, and that because they invest in R&D, they promote future growth. And by the way, we're still watching some of these companies. Like it's pretty incredible that in some of their business still generating 30% top line revenue growth at this size. Like it's unbelievable. But for the first time in, I don't know, 15, 20 years, that I would say, like, there's some valuations that make sense around, you know, these sectors we talked about. So I would say the first time in my personal investing career, and I'm doing some of this within the funds, is I'm actually doing more in equal weighting. Like, my view has been, particularly if you're going to own equities for 10 years, 20 years, I've said, own the fast rivers of cash flow, own the tech companies. But for the first time, I've shifted some into, let's do equal weight, let's do more equal weight, get into more healthcare to find some of these names we talked about. Even, you know, airlines, auto, that, boy, have beaten up the multiples pretty good. Even some of the banks recently, I don't know, the multiples are okay. And so, yeah, for the first time in a while, going into 24, I think doing more equal weight. Again, I wouldn't sell these. I mean, I like still owning a bunch of these tech companies. When you think about the amount of CapEx spend in this country that's going to go in it, if AI is going to be what it is, chip production, GPU expenditure, et cetera, like I wouldn't get out. But anyway, moving the needle a bit, I think makes a bunch of sense today.
We talk about the opportunity set of hanging out in treasuries, which you get a nice yield that we haven't in a long time. But I don't know, of the opportunity set of a dozen other type of bonds that, you know, cross your desk that you spend time with when you're up at 4:30 in the morning. What time do you get up? Your quiet hour?
Come on, 3:45.
Oh my goodness. Up at that quiet time. And listeners, is a fun chat on the last one where if you're making trades at that point, Rick might be on the other side. So tell us a little bit about the world of fixed income, because, you know, one of the challenges I think about is if you got this nice fat yield in treasuries or T-bills, you know, are you getting paid to take on the risk of corporate or emerging market or all these other flavors? It's like a Baskin Robbins, flavors of bonds, when you can get this sort of return in treasuries. So do things look good? Areas that don't look good? Walk us through it.
By the way, part of the reason why I get up so early, I always talk about, like, I trade during London time because it's the crossover between Asia and New York, U.S., and I always call that the unchaperoned period where London, where they tend to overreact to data. So anyway, but away from that. So it's a good question. I mean, would you, like, if you're just comfortable clipping five, you know, it's like, you know, life is good. Like, five is okay. I mean, in our careers, so the last 10 years, the average yield on treasury bills was 0.83%. Five's pretty good. By the way, if you're the U.S. government, it stinks. Because we've got a debt problem. We've got too much debt in this country. The government has too much debt. We're funding it now at 5.5. It's a problem. People realize this. I mean, I think policymakers realize this 2-3 years hence. But as an investor, it's pretty good. As an individual, it's pretty good. But I think people underestimate, like, let's get out the curve a little bit, lock it in. And to your point, do we need to own a lot of high yield? And so one of the things that's unique about bonds today is to get 6.5 now, it's not that hard. To get 8 is hard. I got to go down the credit spectrum. I got to buy some triple C high yield. I got to buy some leveraged loans. I got to get some EM in. We own some EM. We own some high yield. But boy, I like owning it in a place that is respectful of their volatility. And if the economy slows, and listen, I don't think we're going to recession, but we're going to slow. You're going to have some more defaults. EM always wakes you up with a piece of political news. I'm like, wow, I didn't expect that. So I think at the end of the day, like, if you're comfortable with 6.5, like, life is good. And so we're not going to go there. I mean, one of the things that is spectacular, high yield, 72% of the financing in high yield happened when the funds rate was under 1%. These companies took advantage of it. They said, you know what, we're going to get these rates. Remember, high yield was like at 3.5, 4. And so the companies turned their debt out. They don't have a maturity wall. I found that you can't default if you don't have debt maturing. But do you need to own a lot of it? You know, I'd say, you know, in our portfolios today, we're really comfortable owning investment grade credit. We're really comfortable owning agency mortgages. This, you know, you can buy AAA CLOs, clip a really nice yield. So, you know, I'd say high yield EM is a B- in a portfolio. It's not a D, but you don't need to own as much of it.
I wonder, I mean, we touched briefly on stocks and Magnificent Seven. I wonder at what point this attractive yield becomes a vacuum sucking sound. I mean, behaviorally, it's hard to come up with things like the Fed model where, you know, yields compete with equities. But theoretically, I feel like most people actually, you know, believe it. And if they believe it, it might be psychologically impactful on their behavior. And I joke for a long time, my Bank of America rewards, they would email me to tell me that the yield went up from 0.05 to 0.07%, you know, and they were very happy about it. I'm like, whoever sent out that email, I was like, you had to be crazy. But now it's actually 5.07, right? Or whatever it is. How much sort of competition, you know, in your circles, do you chat with people that the flows are starting to compete with fixed income? Because for forever, I mean, all the acronyms, ZIRP, NERP, all these different things where, you know, fixed income was zero. So it was a lot easier to do sort of the comparison. But now that it's at 5, 6, 7, 8, to me, that starts to become a very real competing asset. Is that something you hear or is it impacting behavior yet?
Yes and no. I mean, it should be, but today people have said exactly what you said. People have said, I'm gonna sit in cash, clip 5, and then I'm gonna own equities. And so the technicals in the equity market are maybe the best I've ever seen in my career. So think about the numbers. There's no IPO calendar. 20 billion, I think, has come year to date, maybe 25 billion. There's 800 billion of stock buyback that's happened this year. That's not people's 401k. That's not, I got income coming in. I put X amount in equities. 800 billion stock buyback, normal allocation that goes into equities, and there's no supply. And by the way, you think about the exact opposite of that. Treasury bills, we're issuing 400 billion a week of treasury bills. So like the technos in the equity market are unbelievable. So I think what happens, people sit in cash, then they hold their equities and equities move higher because I think people underappreciate the technicals are incredible. So what I think is going to happen now into 2024 is I think you'll see people take money out of money market funds, put it into bonds because you can clip and lock in some of this yield. We've seen that last month or so. And then I think they'll hold their equities. So I don't think there's a big reallocation, particularly if you think equities, A, the technicals are great, they can throw off this 10% ROE. I just think what happens now is people say, gosh, I don't want to miss the trade. By the way, it's not crazy. If you get a 100 basis point rally in rates, we've had a lot of it recently, you can get double digit returns in stable, like you said, in stable quality assets. And so why not do that? But I don't think there's a reallocation because I just don't think people are long. I mean, look at most strategists. They think the equity market's not going, or they have been not going up that much. People, I look at our competitors, people are underweight equities. So I don't know. I think the equity market is fine. And technically, I'm leaving.
So let's bounce around a little bit. You seem pretty positive and content on the traditional spots, which I think is great. Let's get a little weird. You had referenced Argentina earlier. They got a lot going on down there, as always, a basket case of financial markets. But as you look beyond the shores of traditional assets, so this could be foreign assets, but this could also be real assets. So we haven't even really mentioned commodities, gold, real estate, Bitcoin, all that fun stuff. Any general thoughts afield of the traditional kind of core portfolio that most U.S. investors think about?
We'll go around the world. So first of all, I think Japan's really interesting. For most of my career, like Japanese equities, why? For the first time, you actually have wage inflation. It's really happening. And so I think Japan is an interesting place to get equity exposure. India, you know, India's obviously gotten a huge amount of attention. Stock market there has done well. I actually don't think most of the valuations in India are interesting at all. I mean, what we're doing is doing more mid-cap stuff because you got to find these companies, the big caps, there aren't that many and they trade rich. But India is a place, you know, I think is going to be interesting going forward. You know, we take some shots in parts of China that have really come under pressure. We don't own that much, but there are some interesting individual name stories that I think are worth taking advantage of. EM, I think in local, some of the local rates, I mean, EM's cutting interest rates. A lot of places are. So some of Mex, Brazil, I think are places to take a shot at. And listen, how this gets into the world of controversy, but I think the crypto has proven, you know, particularly some of the, you know, the Bitcoin, et cetera, has proven to be, there's some durability to it. There are more people in the space. And so anyway, it's something that I think more and more people have become receptive to. So
always interesting things that don't die, that are hard to kill. That seems to me to be enduring. Although you can buy gold bars, I learned this past week, you can buy gold bars not only on Costco, but on Walmart's website as well, which Costco announced they sold like 100 million of gold bars, which I found astonishing. But India and China are probably like, oh, please, that's a drop in the bucket. Japan is a particularly interesting one because the amount of people that I've heard similar sentiments, you know, this is an equity market that's essentially had no real returns for 30 plus years. but the amount of under allocation statistics. We posted one on Twitter the other day. We'll add to the show note links about how far it was in our Idea Farm newsletter. It was 75 facts from 2023 that were interesting. And one of them was about how under allocated investors were to Japan. But this is usually true of foreign in general, particularly emerging markets. But Japan is not some tiny economy. You know, it's a top three type of economy and market cap. The governance seemingly is changing. We've seen a lot of buybacks there, which is not something that historically they've done a ton of. So that's going to be a fun one to watch. I'll be over there in about a month. So I'll give some boots on the crown.
Agree. I mean, that's pretty incredible. It's one of the most attractive. The one thing I will say, it's hard finding a lot of great companies that aren't fully priced there. So you got to do a lot of digging. The banks are interesting, these prices, automation, some of the automation companies are interesting, but you definitely have to do your work. Other than, you know, quite frankly, we buy a lot of the index and just topics. We like topics more than Nikkei. So I don't know, but we think it'll probably do okay from here. Some of the auto are interesting as well.
Yeah, we're excited. As excited as a quant can be. I'm excited to cheer for the names that they spit out. The Cambria Global Momentum ETF, ticker GMOM, is a global allocation ETF with a flexible approach to take advantage of recent trends. GMOM will go where the trend and momentum is in the market. Learn how GMOM can help your portfolio. Distributed by Alps Distributors, Inc., member FINRA. Carefully consider the fund's investment objectives, risk factors, charges, and expense before investing. This and other information can be found by visiting our website at www.cambriafunds.com. Read the prospectus carefully before investing or sending money. Investing involves risk, including potential loss of capital. You know, so we've talked about a lot that you seem pretty happy with. Anything where you're like, oh man, this doesn't look good. I don't like this. Stay away. Put this coal in your stocking, this asset, this strategy. Is there anything in particular that you're a little nervous about on assets and various investments?
So, I mean, the one thing that keeps me up at night is I think the U.S. debt issue is a problem.
But how does that ever come to a head, though? Like, everyone, I feel like, worried about this forever. Is this something that just, like, doesn't really matter till it matters?
I think that's exactly right. I think what happens is, so in 2024, are people going to lose sleep over it? No. But what happens is there's a cumulative effect, because if we don't deal with it, then what happens is, and I always say policymakers don't, you know, generally don't deal with things until the shark is right next to the boat. And this is going to get right next to the boat. It's just not going to, in January, it's not going to get next to the boat. What happens is this cumulative effect, because the Treasury issues so much of their debt at the front end of the yield curve, so much in bills, massive amounts in bills. We used to issue them at 0 to 1. Now we're issuing them at 5.5. So what happens is our debt burden and our debt service, which is even more important, just keeps growing and growing and growing. And then 2 years, a year, 2 years hence, the total debt, the debt service is going to eclipse the spend on military, and all the discretionary spend in this country is going to get used up by debt service, military, and then obviously entitlement with mandatory spend. It's a problem. And like, and, you know, is somebody going to deal, you know, we're going to deal with it in 2024? Probably not. But they're going to go through. If you said to me in 2024, they're going to be, you know, you've seen some of this recently, even in a good market, failed auctions for treasuries, because we're issuing at a pop. Like in a given day, we're issuing, what did we have last Monday? $250 billion in a day. We're doing $650 billion a week some days. Like, we'll have a Monday, we'll have a 2-year auction, a 5-year auction, a 13-week treasury bill, a 26-week treasury bill. And like, wow. Like, in between 11:30 and 1 and 1 in the afternoon, 11 Eastern time, in an hour and a half, we're going to price $260 billion. Like, we're going to have, during 2024, like, people aren't going to show up one day for the 7-year note. They'll be like, oh my God. So it's something, it keeps me up at night because it's too big. And I don't think people are going to deal with it. But there'll be, mark my words, there'll be bouts of volatility with it. You know, the other thing, obviously, the geopolitics, you got to really think through, like, where your investments are, given the geopolitics are unpredictable. And then, you know, then you got to keep an eye on China in terms of growth and influence and how that develops over the year. But we're definitely not. I feel like you were saying, I feel okay about things, but I bet it won't, December 31st next year, we won't be sitting like, wow, that was easy.
Maybe the AI overlords will save us or just turn us into pets by then anyway, so it's not going to matter. I want to hear about your ETFs, man. This is exciting. You've launched two now. The first was, I believe, the flexible income ETF, BINC, and then the total return ETF, BRTR. Give us a little overview.
So, I mean, the first one is this one bank that is that we're running as a high income ETF. So we're trying to keep it at about 7% yield. You know, recently we've dipped down to 6.5% to your comments earlier. Like, you know, is it worth stretching to get 7%? I don't think so. So we're going to let it run at about 6.5%. The idea being diversify it, securitized assets, parts of, you know, investment grade, European investment grade, just be tactical. Anyway, the reason why it's grown fast, quite frankly, a lot faster than I thought. We've gotten a huge amount of nice notes on it, media around it, and I think it's a headline today. It's just being tactical, create 6.5% with low volatility. And I think we have, like, we literally are 100% of the yield of the high, of the double B high yield market, and we're half the volatility. So it's gotten a lot of attention. I think it's going to grow quite a bit. I think in the beginning of the year, people more and more are looking to get that yield with, and like I say, there's 68,000 securities in fixed income. It's a hard market if you're not in it day and minute to minute. And so we use a lot of research.
Well, I think that, not to interrupt you, but that's such an important point. And we talk to investors a lot about this. We say, look, you know, global stock market, the US stock market, you're talking about thousands of securities, and global, you know, maybe 10,000 really investable in the private markets on, like, say, private equity type of investments. There's a lot of arguments that I think are bunk and bogus in the private equity world, the no volatility angle that Cliff talks a lot about and a bunch of others. But breadth, meaning the number of choices, to me, is the one they should be talking a lot about, where there's orders of magnitude more choices. And the same thing is true in your world, where fixed income, I mean, my God, it tens of thousands of potential choices out there of every flavor. Most of them, it's not as easy as just buying, you know, Goog or IBM on your E-Trade account either. So it's a lot more complex area.
So you think about, like, if people say commercial real estate, like, oh my God, I don't think it's commercial. Actually, you think about places like hotels and the dynamic around hotel financing. And by the way, because of the stress in some places in the banking system, you get to finance some of these businesses with great collateral, great structure, great covenants, cash flow sweep, et cetera. But it's pretty complex unless you're in it, doing it, you know, and are you financing at the top of the stack, bottom of the stack? It's really complex. So anyway, but the beauty of it is you can finance at attractive levels. And so it's a big part of fixed income. And we do more in our mutual funds, but some in the ETFs where we can. But like you say, it's a really diverse, you know, set of things you do. So that, anyway, that's this big one that we're super excited about. But we just launched BlackRock Total Return, which is pretty similar to what we run in mutual fund form, a total return fund, similar to a core plus strategy or a core plus strategy where people say, gosh, I own equities and I want to have that 40. This gets me the 40 and has outperformed the ag almost, I think, every year, or almost every year for I don't know how many straight years, but gets you some of the additional return because we can do things, eliminate bad parts of the index. One of the other secrets in fixed income, the more you lever, more you put on debt, the more you are in the index. Like, that's not where you want to go. And there's some parts of the index that trade too rich, like agency debt or supranational debt trades at like nothing. Like, why, you know, you can buy treasuries at the same level virtually. So we cut that stuff out. We cut out parts of the yield curve that don't make a lot of sense today. Like, we're talking about the long end. Like, why own it? We might do more in fives, sevens, tens. So anyway, we're excited about that people will use it and are starting to use it for, I can marry that to my equity portfolio, create my 40, do in a way that's efficient, use because where people use ETFs for tax strategies, et cetera.
How should investors, so like, let's say there's some advisors listening to this call and they say, okay, I'm going to check these tickers out. How do they think in terms of conversations? Because we've had some over the years where with the way we thought investors may use these funds, maybe didn't turn out to be the actual way they use them. But is there a way you kind of talk to investors and say, hey, look, this is how we think about positioning these funds in your portfolio, the core satellite, replacements for ag, blah, blah, blah. Where should investors that are doing like a strategic allocation slot these in?
So, you know, like everything, it depends on like how much do I own in equities, how much do I own in real estate, what do I own in private equity, et cetera. So the way I would think about it though, in these two funds, like the income fund is one I say, gosh, I want to hold a lot of income. And then, you know, we don't run as much duration, as much interest rate sensitivity. So we'll run a 2.5 year, 2.5, 2.75 year duration. So it's not going to move around as much as interest rates, but it's a lot of income and it should do its job. And if rates rally, you know, it'll do its job and throw off a lot of income. The total return one is much more of an ag if I own a lot of equities, I own a lot of beta, it's got a longer duration to it, by 3 or 4 years longer duration to it. It'll move. And if interest rates go up, it's not going to perform as well. But if interest rates drop, total return will give you a really good, particularly if we're in that normalized world where economy really slows. You want that interest rate sensitivity. You want that attached to your equity portfolio. And so that's how people say, gosh, I want to own some total return. Similar to the way people owned it for 30 years when rates came down. So now, because there's more, you've got a Fed that's more two-way, and we'll look at, gosh, they'll cut rates if the economy slows, but all they'll leave it here. It's a pretty good hedge now. You know, whereas for the last 3 years, in the way you open the show, it's like it wasn't, because it was, inflation moved up, you got hurt on rates and you got hurt on equities. But now it's much more two-way. So anyway, so but they're different. And, you know, I would, depending on, you know, how much equities do you have, how much beta do you have, how much real estate, et cetera, I would implement them differently based on that.
Good, just buying both. So do you guys still do, I don't know if in these strategies, but I know in some of your others, you do some hedging, and I don't know if it's through shorting futures or how you guys swaps or how you guys do it. Are you doing that in these funds too, or is it purely long only sort of?
Not as much. I mean, so these funds, the idea being they're puzzle pieces for this income, the one bank that we talked about. You're going to buy that income and it'll have some volatility. It has a lot less volatility than anything else than the ag, than high yield, et cetera. What we do is we tactically move around. We'll take some beta down. We'll get more in a high quality, but it's going to do what it's going to do. Same thing with total return. We'll, you know, move around tactically. In our mutual funds, I do a lot of hedging. I run an unconstrained fund called SIO, Strategic Income Opportunities. I do a lot of hedging. I use equity options. I use the dollar. I use a lot of hedging to try and keep. Pretty proud of it. We've done almost, you know, more than double the return of the ag at half the vol for a long, long time. But I'm using a lot of hedging tools. The idea in the ETF is it's going to do what it's going to do, and you can put it in a model and assume that it's going to have this. But it will have more volatility, more sincere to what we're trying to, what somebody presumably was trying to achieve for that tool.
Cool. Well, listeners, check those out. By the time we talk to him next year, he'll probably have like four more funds. So we'll keep an eye out and we'll update on the ETF landscape. Let's bounce around with some other ideas. You know, anything on this past year really surprised you? I think either in the macro economy or in the investing world where you kind of look back and shake your head a little bit and say, wow, that was weird, or that wasn't what I expected.
So, gosh, I'm going to think through. I mean, obviously, you always think about the things that are most recent. Like the shift in the Fed, like, was unbelievable. Like in 2 weeks, 3 weeks. And by the way, the data didn't change that much. But like all of a sudden, the Fed going from, we got more to do on inflation, we got more, like, all right, now we're going to start cutting. Right, I've been pretty blown away by that. How fast? Because usually I was on the Fed's Investor Advisory Committee for 8 years. I mean, they're very pragmatic about communicating, setting people up for a transition. I'm like, that was fast. Anyway, my guess is the markets think it's faster than it really is. But anyway, that was surprising. The long end of the yield curve, as the economy slowed, I mean, an incredible bid at 4% for long bonds. I think a lot of it's pension and life insurance that are less sensitive because they're matching a liability. But wow, like I don't know why people want to own that asset. That's been surprising. The equity market, I mean, I think the technicals in the equity market are incredible. The technology performance has been amazing. And then obviously the inception, you know, the growth. I think a lot of it, people say it's AI, definitely. But boy, I think people underestimate these businesses throw off a lot of cash and they reinvest in R&D. But the price performance after last year, I mean, it pretty blows you away.
The rivers of cash flow. I tell you, these tech firms, you know, what's interesting to me has been, I think most American investors, we talk a lot about at this point in the cycle, are not as interested in foreign investments, but we've started to see a lot of interesting tech companies, tech stocks in the emerging market space, where it's combining a bit of the fundamentals, but also the performance and momentum, which is really what hasn't been there for a long time. China has, I think, really struggled this year, but other countries are doing quite a bit better.
Hey, Mev, can I throw one other thing that I think is interesting?
Throw out more than one. Throw out a dozen.
The other thing that's been extraordinary, and I think we caught this okay, but is this dynamic around healthcare change and like this GLP-1, the Eli Lilly's and Novo Nordisk. I think the next couple of years, I mean, this was an extraordinary, and the impact it had on companies, you wouldn't even think that it impacted it from kidney to heart failure, et cetera. Pretty remarkable. And I think for the next couple of years, we're going to see something around the ability to deconstruct DNA. You're seeing some, you know, hopefully encouraging things on cancer development, brain health. I got the next couple of years could be a pretty amazing point in time. And you spend a lot of time looking at companies trying to figure out where do you get into some of these spaces. But I think that's going to be, you know, see, when you throw out things that surprised you, is we think that technology is real and we think it's, but the impact it had, like all of a sudden, like McDonald's stock came under pressure because people were worried about the GLP-1. Like, wow, did you think, you know, people would eat less Big Macs? I guess that's a pretty amazing thing. And I think the next couple of years, knock wood, we're going to see some pretty wild discoveries, I think.
Yeah. You know, I cut my teeth coming out of university. My first job was a biotech analyst. And this was all the excitement. Listeners who, you know, as big as the internet bubble was, there was equally as impactful sort of biotech bubble, because the original sequencing of the human genome, which how many ever billions it cost at that point. And today, I think it's sub $1,000 now. I just sent off my swab. I can't say swab without saying Schwab. My swab of my DNA to a company to get sequenced. And I think it was like $500 for the whole kit and caboodle. I haven't got it back yet. So who knows where it's going. But biotech, it feels like it, in a Gattaca sense, has really turned the corner. You're starting to see a lot of these therapies. One of my biggest whiffs, you know, I'm a quant guy. So every stock pitch I hear, one of the reasons I'm a quant is they all sound good to me. I used to go to like the Value Investing Congress. I listened to Buffett or these, all these hedge fund managers, and every pitch or every even time I read Barron's, I'll go read, you know, listen to you guys talk about best investments next year. And they all sound good to me. But I had a buddy, Steve Sugarud, shout out to Steve, who is like a year and a half ago, he was talking about these drug companies and he's talking about Lilly and Novo. And he said, these, you want to be buying these stocks. And he said, I lost 50 pounds on this already. And I just kind of nodded him. I said, my discretionary stock picking days are long behind me. But in the last year, I wish I'd have listened to him, because they, the impact they're going to have, it could theoretically, even though everyone knows about it now, be understated if it really has the impacts in the world of, say, alcoholism and other areas. You know, I'm sure there'll be some side effects too. Hopefully not, fingers crossed, but it's exciting. Now, the crazy part is if you look at the biotech stock charts, a lot of these biotech ETFs, I mean, you got a little run in the last month, but they straight up have had zero returns since 2015, close to. Some of them, depends on the index you use. But you're going on better part of almost a decade. They really peaked in 21.
I'm going to tell you, I mean, we're in the business every day of working on, you know, big research teams. It is hard picking them.
It's going to be exciting. Fun times. And we're all going to live to 100 or start planning for it. All right. So let's say after this, you're going to a holiday party. You're sitting around drinking some eggnog or having a coffee with your team tomorrow, casual lunch. And you make a statement. And these are your peers. So 75% of them shake their head. They look at you and they're like, Rick doesn't know what he's talking about. What is a belief? It could be a framework. It could be a very specific, I think this is going to happen, blah, blah, blah. I think this is something else. What is a belief you hold that, say, 75% of your peers at this holiday party, at this lunch, would shake their head and say, I disagree with Rick. I think he's crazy.
So the one that I keep espousing, depending on, I think someone being on your show, like, I don't think the economy's going, you know, I think this idea of investing in equities, like there's cycles, like this is the classic. I don't think there's a classic anymore. People think I'm nuts about this. You have an economy, 70% services, 70% consumption oriented, and the variability on spend on healthcare and education, and it doesn't really change that much. You know, there's been, I think it's 13 quarters in 100 years. That we've had negative growth in services. And during recessions, the average growth is 2% growth. I just don't buy the whole, yes, there's some variability, economy slowing. I don't agree with that. People say you have their respect for history. I think you have to have a healthy disrespect for history. You don't follow it because others do and it impacts the technicals of the market. But like, life is different. Like, you know, regimes shift, things change. And I think people always look for the analog to, like, this is what happened historically. And I think most of that, like, I think you have to know it because others follow it. But I don't know. I think, you know, I go to a party and people say, well, you know, think about this is just like the, and I'm like, Actually, I don't think that way. I don't know. I think you always have to identify the regime and think about where we're operating. I'll throw out another thing. I think surveys, like this industry loves surveys. Like, what are people feeling? How they feel? People all feel the same way at the same time. Like, if the market's going down, everybody's like negative on the economy. They're negative on everything. And then, by the way, you know, I think what is the story? Like, the surveys or the yield curve predict like 8 out of the last 3 recessions. Like, they stink. And, you know, it's like polling. It's like election polling. It's like they stink. I'm a big believer. Like, study the data. Like, I want to hear, like, companies. I want to know, like, we're looking at some of the retailers recently. Who's buying electronics? Who's buying, you know, they're buying apparel, they're buying electronics. Are they not doing as much in goods? They're doing more in services. Like, I think this industry spends way too much time, like, surveying other people. And everybody gives the same answer. Like, I don't. By the way, there's a bunch of things that I think blow me away about, like, the consistency of, like, the it's accepted that some of these things. And I just think things are different. I think you got to evaluate. Now, I'll throw one other thing you may have said. Like, I believe in quant. I believe in fundamental. And I actually think that it's the marriage of the two that really is successful. Like, and I think you just got to do, like, on the fundamental, you got to do all your work and to understand, like, why is, you know, like we just talked about, like, why is healthcare different than it was 5 years ago? And why is, and then use your quant to understand who's long, who's short. Because, by the way, it won't perform if everybody's already long. And so I do a bunch of like trying to figure that out, marry the fundamental and the quant, because I just don't think either of them individually is durable from in terms of consistent performance. Anyway, one on Matt's opinion.
You hit a couple of things that I think are really interesting. I mean, you know, using history as a guide, but realizing it's always different, I think that's pretty instructive and instrumental, really, because so many times I feel like investors aren't prepared because they haven't studied history. But if you hold it as a Bible where it's like, you know, guaranteed to look like the past, it becomes problematic when things get even weirder, which they're bound to do. I mean, COVID was pretty weird, but we're always hitting things that have never happened before. And that's the hard and makes this fun and challenging, is trying to decide when these times are actually real or it is something that reverts. Sentiment's tough, though. You know, we look at a lot of the sentiment surveys, and I think they're interesting from sort of a magazine cover standpoint. But as far as placing, you know, investing decisions on them, it's usually more obvious in retrospect than it is, you know, kind of concurrent. But others feel differently. But I find it hard. I like talking about it, but I find it hard.
No, I totally agree. I think you got to bring a lot of tools to the fight every day.
As you look out into 24, and this is a bit of an open-ended question, so you can take this a couple different ways. You know, if you think about, you can say what's on your brain that you're excited or worried about. But the other one is what, as you look back, what sort of content, book, idea influenced you most this year? And if you got one, good, we can talk about it. If you don't, I have one also that I'm going to bring up either before or after. But is there anything you're thinking about, anything you're streaming as the year comes down, any good presents that suggest giving out?
I'm a big gadget geek. I am maniacal about, like, I love all the new cool stuff that is out. By the way, part of why, like, tech is less, like, they're not, they apply the hardware companies. There's not that many interesting new technologies. You know, you go back in time and there was the iPhone or the AirPod or whatever it was. There's not that many that I think are that exciting now. You know, I will say that, there was a Wharton study, was with OpenAI, that there was this collaboration that talked about the impact of large language models. And when was it? 6 months ago, 9 months ago. And I remember reading it and thinking, and the story was 80% of job function would be affected. And it was, I forget the number, but something like it would eliminate 20 to 35, 40% of the jobs. That thing really, it helped me around, whether it's investing in some of the chip companies, who are the winners in AI. And by the way, I don't think it's clear who those winners, and I think the markets overreact on some there versus others, but I don't know. I mean, it's hard to, when you rewrite 2023, it's hard to say. And there were some studies I read that really blew me away about that this could be the real deal.
The real deal, Holyfield. You know, it's funny. I talked to a lot of friends that have implemented AI extensively into their personal or business life. I've toyed with it a lot. I played around with it. We've recorded my voice and trained podcasts where they could read it. but from more of a just curiosity standpoint, so listeners, if you have any major use cases or ideas you're using, shoot me an email. I'm curious to hear. I have some friends that have implemented extensively and absolutely go nuts, swear by it. So 2024, it's going to be on my to-do list. Are you implementing it on a daily basis yet or found any great use cases?
So I think the place where we are using it the most is two places. One, it's helping us absorb a lot of data. We use tons of systems, help us absorb signals and globally to look at indicators around the economy, look at, you know, pull from corporate results around what home builders are saying about the housing market, et cetera. That's been really, really instructive for us. And that I think will keep growing. And I would say we're scratching the surface of what can be done there. The second is we do a ton with portfolio construction and the ability to run mass simulations and just run it over and over again and use technology broadly, artificial and otherwise. That's been really, really try and manage, stress test and manage what you're doing. Those are the big ones. By the way, today somebody took one of the things I wrote and I guess you could do it in somebody else, in other people's style, like rewrite this.
Take Rick's annual letter and put it in the style of Warren Buffett or Peter Lynch. That's actually a good idea, is like to take something and then get like five other famous investors and write it in their style. Maybe we'll try for Meb's year-end letter. That's a great idea.
Never knew you could do that. That was, but anyway, I think we're learning a ton more. What I'm, you know, for our business, I think assimilating, I'm talking about, I don't really love surveys. I use them, but I really love, like, if we can get these companies come out with, you know, these retailers, there's so much information in terms of what's really impacting consumption. And if we can absorb that quickly and not just quickly, but comprehensively, so that we're not pivoting off of noise, like somebody said something that was, if we can use it comprehensively, that's pretty powerful.
Yeah, it's kind of fun to see what goes down. Certainly in the startup investing world, it's like, it's certainly over a third, but it's probably half of the startups I see are AI flavored. And of course, all of them are close to pre-revenue. Also, some of them are really starting to get some traction. Big differentiator versus, I think, a lot of the traditional crypto space was you're seeing infinite use cases and actual revenue generating companies and products pretty quickly, which is going to be fun to watch.
It's like you have to take a step back in time. Like, do you know we lived for like, particularly in fixed income, we lived in this think about negative yields, how crazy that is. And I just think, you know, what am I excited about 2024? It's like getting yield for years. Like, I mean, rates were at zero. We had to buy high yield at 3.5, and you knew it was stupid. You knew that it was not stupid. You can outperform for a period of time, but you knew ultimately that asset was not a fruitful asset, and you just had to be tactical about getting out when you wanted to get out. Like, this is a pretty cool. Like, I'm pretty energized going to 2024. Like, getting this sort of yield and trying to lock it in, like that. You know, as a fixed income person, that.
No, I hear you. That was a weird time. Looking back on it, I mean, we've seen a lot of crazy stuff in the past couple of decades. The negative yielding sovereigns and trying to like how to think about doing the math on something like a negative yielding mortgage. Just
lending money to companies. And like, by the way, we're going to lend you money and we're going to pay you for the right to do it. How is that possible? Like, it's insane. Looking at like these European companies, they all have been invited to US companies as well. They took the money. And now these companies have like, they have no debt needs. So a lot of them, the big investment grade companies. So that's part of why it's weird. You're getting the yield for them and they don't, and the risk is down because they took advantage of it. But lending money is crazy. Paying them is crazy.
Part of what you were saying earlier on the US consumer being, you know, particularly strong, I think not a trivial amount has to do with their wealth in real estate, but also the mortgages, the vast majority being at locked in at low levels, you know, they're not floating. And so the rates going up doesn't affect them maybe the way that they would have in the past.
No, people underestimate it. The leverage in the system, it's because the lower income, the bottom 10% is hurting a bit because you didn't have the facility or ability to do that. But, you know, generally within housing, a ton of that was done. And so the overall leverage is a pretty good position.
Rick, it's been awesome. Where do people find out about the ETFs, what you're up to, what you're writing about? Where's the best place to go?
I mean, it's the BlackRock website, and we have it on BlackRock.com, and we have a ton of information on it. And then the new ETFs. It's just, you know, the ticker symbol BINC and BRTR, and Yeah, knowing what we have on our website is great. I appreciate people. I appreciate your mentioning people taking a look at them.
Yeah. Rick, thanks so much for joining us again. We'll have to do it again next year.
That'd be great. Thanks for having me.
Podcast listeners, will post show notes to today's conversation at mebfaber.com/podcast. If you love the show, if you hate it, shoot us feedback at themebfabershow.com. We love to read the reviews. Please review us on iTunes and subscribe to the show anywhere good podcasts are found. Thanks for listening, friends, and good investing.